Dear friends, I'm not only very happy to be here in this wonderful city, in this beautiful Congress, but also that I'm asked to introduce this evening's speaker. You will have seen in the program where it says, Miss Joy Mills, American lecturer, former vice president of the Theosophical Society, and former national president of the American and Australian sections. I would like to fill you in what that in practice means. It means traveling to the ends of the earth. It means if you have an office like this, you travel every year millions of miles just in that large section of America, United States. You travel also to other parts of the world as a representative of that section. And in addition, now being president of the American section, of the Australian section, means another traveling of the earth, because when I came here in the aircraft, they had a display showing how Australia fits into the United States. And it fits, leaves off Alaska and all that, but on the sides it overlaps. So that means another million of miles traveling, visiting all the groups. And that alone is a major achievement. Then you will not forget the many years of work at the Crotona Institute. So the next thing that everybody bribes about is the membership of the Theosophical Society. Now, who can say that he has been a member since 1940? That means 60 years of dedicated service to theosophical ideas, to bring this to all the different groups, to see that everything is in a line that we call theosophy and not maybe some derivative, as we might like to call it. And on the other hand, it means constantly working for oneself, because what can we give out that we have not in ourselves? So, since 1940, 60 years, 61 years, beginning of this service. And there's something else I would like to tell you from the practical aspect. While visiting Germany, there was this saying, excuse me, wouldn't it be wonderful if the European Congress would come to Germany? So, for a while, one thinks, too big to boots. But then, quickly follows up the European Federation, saying, oh, I have heard you plan to organize the European Congress in Germany. Huh? If you see a similarity to Australia and to the World Congress, all right, I leave it to you. So, it gives me great pleasure, and I would like you to give a good welcome to Miss Joy Mills, who is going to speak to us tonight, this afternoon, on crossing threshold on the inward journey.
Yes, fine. Thank you, Elizabeth, very much, and good afternoon, friends. In deference to my legs, I sit. And it doesn't matter whether you can see me or not, because that's irrelevant. I'm always fascinated by what chairmen are going to say about me anyway. I always feel in some sense that they're talking about somebody else. And I think that sounds like an interesting person. Someday I'd like to meet that person. Well, friends, for how many years we have been hearing talks, reading articles, listening to prophecies about the dawn of the new millennium. We're here now. The new millennium has begun, presumably. A time both anticipated and dreaded, a time about which so many prophecies have been made. Even H.P. Blavatsky, in concluding The Key to Theosophy, had a prophecy. She indulged in prophecy when she proposed that should the Theosophical Society survive and, to quote her, live true to its mission, to its original impulses through the next 100 years, and we have survived 125 years, then perhaps, she said, Earth will be a heaven in the 21st century. Well, we have yet to see what this century is going to bring, what this new millennium will hold for humanity. And much of it, I propose, rests in our hands and our willingness to venture forth on that new continent of thought of which her teachers wrote. We know, of course, that the date marking the beginning of the new millennium, the new century, is a purely fictional one. It was fabricated out of the calculations that were made by a rather obscure monk who lived in Rome, in now what we refer to, according again to his calculations, as the 6th century of our era. And we know, if we know anything at all about the diverse cultures and histories of peoples around the globe, that other calendars and other dates and other modes of telling time have been used to mark the passage of years, of centuries, of millennia. But the calendar that has come to be universally accepted is the one on which that fictional or mythical date has been placed. And so, in some way, we have all come to accept that we have been present at the dawn of a new millennium. And we're now content to speak and write about events that occurred 5 million and 10 million and 30 million years ago, about the likelihood of events that may occur 1 year or 10 years or 20 years from now, all in accordance with that Gregorian calendar by which we agreed that this would be the time and the place for us to gather for the 9th World Congress of the Society. So there is a kind of tacit agreement among us that we understand what is meant by the passage of time. But there's another metaphor that in so many ways is more appropriate to our lives as theosophists, as spiritual seekers after truth and understanding and wisdom. A metaphor that marks not so much the passage of time as the growth of the soul. For as H.P.B. told us, it is the spiritual evolution of the inner, immortal man that forms the fundamental tenet in the occult sciences. So I would suggest then that it is less the dawning of a new calendric year or century or millennium, which is our concern. Or indeed, if I may put it this way, what we do in the external world about us during this particular period. But if we are to bring ourselves in tune with the universe, then we need to give attention to that spiritual evolution, which is our inward journey, the inward journey of the soul. And that our work is not a work, as H.P.B. herself said, of years, even of centuries. It is a work for millennia to come. It is a work to which we have given our hands to change the thought patterns of the world. We are all called to live at times between two worlds, the objective world of our everyday existence, that world of calendric time, of course, in which we must do what we can do and should do, and are called upon to do, to aid the world's sorrow. This is the world of Kronos, if you like. And the world, the subjective world, the inner world of thought and feeling, of aspiration and knowing, where existence really seems far more real, that inner world of Kairos, as St. Paul called it. And in that inner world, time is no longer linear. Time, in fact, becomes irrelevant. Thomas More, author of Care of the Soul, has referred to that world in these words. There are places in this world that are neither here nor there, neither up nor down, neither real nor imaginary. And these I would call the in-between places, the thresholds, if you like, which we cross on this inward journey. The very word threshold, of course, may conjure up so many images, some rather fearful, some beautiful. And it is on our inward journey that there are places to be crossed at great risk, as all the spiritual texts remind us. And there are places across which we may move with great ease and confidence. The word threshold derives from the Latin terere and from the Greek tornos, both referring to a turning, a rubbing, and meaning also the process of beating out grain or seed by treading or striking the husks so as to free the grain within. A threshold, then, used as a metaphor for our inward journey, is the place of the soul's threshing. And the thresholds to be crossed demand an inner threshing which releases the true self from its bondage to the personality. I am always reminded in thinking of this of a stanza in a beautiful Shaker hymn. The Shakers were a religious group that originated in England in the mid-18th century and who believed, among other things, in leading a very simple life under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. There's a beautiful hymn in which one stanza is, "When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we shan't be ashamed. To turn, turn will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right." It is that turning, as with a lathe, that removes our rough edges, that threshes off the excrescences that hide the immortal self. How many threshold experiences have we had? Often without even being aware that we stood at a threshold or crossed one. Consider, have you ever stood on the threshold of a room or a house, almost afraid to enter? Have you ever been caught between dreaming and waking, suspended on a kind of threshold between knowing and non-knowing? Each of us, I think, can remember a moment when a door seemed to open, together with the feeling that it might not remain open for very long. Perhaps a decision was required, and we paused figuratively on the threshold, unable to go either forward or back. It has been suggested, in fact, that to view one's life as consisting of a series of thresholds would instill a kind of creative attitude into the process of living, an attitude that can bring a realization of the infinite possibilities of one's existence. Again, to quote Thomas More, "This is the key point about thresholds," he wrote. "They are not the place of life and not the place of death. In their narrow confines, you may find fantasy, memory, dream, anxiety, miracle, intuition, and magic. This is a good place from which to make a decision and get a hunch. It is the true home of creativity. And he quotes the French philosopher Gaston Bachelard, "If one were to give an account of all the doors one has closed and opened, of all the doors one would like to reopen, one would have to tell the story of one's entire life." Though it's true that standing in a doorway, on a threshold, you're often forced into the imagination, wondering what you will find on the other side. The well-known historian of religions, Murshi Eliade, has written of the threshold as the limit, the boundary, the frontier that distinguishes and opposes two worlds, and at the same time, the paradoxical place where those worlds communicate, where passage from the profane to the sacred world becomes possible. And the philosopher Martin Heidegger has spoken of the threshold as a space between two worlds, a middle ground that simultaneously holds, joins, and separates the two. That joining is the threshold. In the terminology of the sacred doctrine, the thresholds between the levels of manifested existence, as well as between the domains of our human constitution, are referred to as laya centers, those zero points, as it were, or mystical points where one thing disappears in order and becomes, by transition, reappearing at another level, in another form or substance. In fact, HPB, speaking of these points, resorts to symbol and allegory, as she so often does, to describe these transitional or threshold states in the building of a cosmos. Well, it is not my intent to take us that far afield, but I would remind you that it is precisely because myth and allegory do not refer to historical chronological time that they depict so well the journey of the soul, a journey never taken in time, but always out of time. Because they call us to the immediacy of the significant moment of inner awakening. So in recounting first some of the mythological references to met thresholds, I'm not concerned with their historicity, but rather, as in the telling of all myths, with what they tell us about our own interior journey. The great epic of India, the Ramayana, concludes, at least in some versions, with the story of Sita stepping across the threshold of her husband's home in violation of the promise she had given to his brother. And Sita is then rejected by society. She has stepped across the boundary of duty, the social order, the line of Dharma, the threshold which separates the domestic culture of the home from the wilderness, although she did so in obedience to a higher law, the law of compassion. In many Indian, traditional Indian households, since women are confined to the home, the men have to cross the threshold repeatedly to bring home food and wealth. Stepping out results in pollution. Stepping in necessitates purification. Hence, rituals must be performed so that stepping across the threshold, either going out or coming in, may be lawful and in accordance with the nature of things. I know a number of people who, while perhaps not performing specific rituals, do have certain customs which they perform almost unconsciously when crossing the thresholds of their homes. One friend, for example, never leaves the house without saying a blessing on the home, and she never returns without a prayer of gratitude to the house for its protection. In many traditions, there are clear markers to establish boundaries around villages or fields, boundaries that define the threshold between the inhospitable wilderness and the orderly social life of the village, of the cultivated field, or the cultivated field. Doorkeepers, sometimes of fanged and armed, demonic-looking figures, are often placed at entrances to temples, marking the thresholds between the profane and the sacred. Mara Freeman, who presents workshops on Celtic and British folklore and mythology, has pointed out that the floor, generally earthen, just inside the threshold of old Irish cottages, was known as the welcome of the door. And upon entering, a visitor would stand there and say a blessing on the household. The threshold was that in-between place, holy ground, said to be neither here nor there, but it allowed a crack to open between the worlds where power could seep in. Those skilled in walking between the worlds, as it were, knew how to harness the power of the threshold. And in the Celtic landscape are many thresholds to secret that secret country of the gods and fairies, and many Irish legends warn of the dangers of crossing the threshold into the realm of faery. Today, in our demythologized and desacralized worldview, the doors of the fairy hills remain sealed, simply because we keep the eyes of our mythic consciousness firmly shut. Few, it seems, dare to open what W.B. Yeats called the flaming door and explore the power that crackles on the thresholds of our vaunted reality structures. But there are thresholds to be crossed if we would take that inward journey to the one self, the one reality. There is, of course, a danger to be found in threshold places, and leaping over thresholds is not to be taken lightly. The cultures of archaic and classical Greece and Egypt treated points of transformation as thresholds to be crossed with respect. The threshold into the mysteries, for example, was of a dual nature. It was both a barrier and a point of transformation. And in those cultures, the duality was embodied in the god Hermes, who functioned as a guardian of thresholds and as a guide for those who crossed them. In fact, Hermes became the patron of all who crossed thresholds. He was himself a messenger who crosses the boundary between the world of the gods and the world of the humans. Travelers in ancient Greece created piles of stone called Herma, after the god Hermes, to signify the crossing of frontiers separating political territories. And each passing traveler would place a stone on one of these to signify recognition of the boundary crossed. I sometimes wonder what it would be, what our world would be like if we respected all the boundaries we cross from country to country and from continent to continent, and we paid tribute to the gods of the countries we entered. A study of the rituals and the gods associated with the Greek sanctuaries reveals how an abiding respect for thresholds gave order and stability to life and made transformation meaningful. Many of the thresholds mark the passage from one stage of life to another, from childhood to adulthood, from adulthood to old age, as well as from life to death, and from death to rebirth. Sanctuaries, for example, to the goddess Demeter, whose story was reenacted in the Eleusinian Mysteries, were usually located at the limits of cultivated land. And Demeter herself sat at the threshold that separated life from death, as the goddess Artemis was at the threshold between childhood and adulthood. So at each stage of life's way, both inner and outer, there is a door to be opened, a threshold to be crossed. Sometimes the door is obscurely marked or not marked at all, but a door there is if we remain vigilant. Traditional societies, and I've referred only to a very few, took care in respecting boundary conditions, for they knew that the guardians of thresholds are often merciless. They may cut down anyone who attempts to cross without an inner humility, a humility of spirit coupled with a bravery of soul that is willing to endure the threshing. Perhaps the best-known guardian of thresholds is the one which was given life by Edward Bulwer Lytton in his occult novel Zanoni, and referred to on at least two occasions by Mr. Sinnott's adept teacher, K.H. In Bulwer Lytton's novel, the candidate for instruction meets an awesome and demonic figure called the Dweller on the Threshold. And this appears to be a recurrent figure in all esoteric lore, where confronting the Dweller is inevitably portrayed as a life-shattering event. The author, Richard Smalley, has written that in the Kabbalah, the Dweller on the Threshold, sometimes known as the Sentinel, is connected with the principal Dat, or knowledge. The Kabbalistic Tree of Life, comprised of 10 principles, or Sephirot, is considered, which were considered as emanations of the divine that disclose themselves in the worlds of spirit, psyche, and matter. That in that scheme, Dat, the Dweller on the Threshold, is an unmistakable 11th element, a paradoxical non-Sephiroth, or as Smalley suggests, that it means knowledge and gives us a clue to the identity of the Dweller, a knowledge of a much higher kind than mere factual knowledge or technical information. Perhaps one could even say that the Dweller on the Threshold is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And eating the fruit of this tree was not one simple act done by a mythical ancestor thousands of years ago, but seen as something that each of us is doing all the time, an essential part of our human condition. Consequently, the Dweller on the Threshold may be seen as that core part of ourselves where the decision to know good and evil takes place. And we could say that the entire human condition is the result of that decision to know the mixed world of good and evil that we encounter every day. One Kabbalist has called it the seed of I, the point within us where we lose awareness of our unity with the divine and experience ourselves as separate individuals. In fact, it is that sense of the all-important I, in the cases of both A.O. Hume and A.P. Sinnott, and particularly of Saint and Moses, to which the Mahatma K.H. refers when speaking of the Dweller on the Threshold as depicted in Bulwer Lytton's novel. And in that novel, Bulwer Lytton indicates that the initiate must encounter that dweller or sentinel, face the primal fear that undergirds our experience of ourselves as separate individuals, because the inward journey to real knowledge involves a genuine purging of all sense of a personal, separated self. This is the threshing that must take place if we would move onwards, the husk of egoism removed that the true self may be revealed. So what are the thresholds to be crossed on this inward journey? Every journey contains its own metaphor, for we're all the time being addressed by images. In imagination, we conjure up these images which seem most congenial to us and which seem most helpful, images which we feel depict our own struggles and triumphs on the journey to our goal. I have friends, for example, who mark off the days on the calendar, putting a large X through each day as it concludes, and then counting the number of days left in a week, a month, or a year, feeling that this outer mode of marking the journey somehow relates to the steps on an inner path. Other people keep journals, not a diary, which records events of each day, although that too can be useful, perhaps, in seeing where one has been and what one has done, but a journal in which no dates may even appear, but in which are written thoughts and feelings, descriptions of significant moments. Such a journal may record the progress of inner illuminations, understanding, and even the darker moments of despair and discouragement, the soul suffering, the threshing that one has undergone. Though such journals are often filled with images that in themselves tell the story of the inward journey. They tell of doors that have opened on new understanding and doors that remain firmly closed. We all, therefore, have our favorite images to depict this inward journey. One of the most beautiful series of images involving the profound metaphor of thresholds to be crossed, certainly one of my own favorites, as I consider the journey to be undertaken, and therefore the one which I intend to impose on you this afternoon, to share with me that those images that have been so meaningful to me, is the one that is found in the work of the 16th century mystic, Western mystic, Teresa of Avila. In her major work, The Interior Castle, we have the imagery of the pilgrim soul moving from room to room. Rooms, or chambers as she called them, arranged in seven concentric circles or rings, each an abode or dwelling place holding unique experiences for the courageous traveler. I realize, of course, that castles are not much in favor today, and I don't know why, as an American, I'm drawn to this image of the interior castle, perhaps some reminiscence of former lives and lived out in the dungeons of those castles. But somehow, I have always loved it. And what appeals to me most, however, in the imagery of Saint Teresa is the concentric nature of the journey through the seven rooms, giving the journey a kind of spiral ascent rather than that awful, what I think of as awful, ladder-like arrangement, which I think is too often used in our classification of the human constitution as well as the domains of manifested existence. For they are all here, all present, right now, and all seven rooms of her interior castle are here now within each one of us. Be that as it may, Teresa warns of the dangers involved in crossing thresholds from one room to the next. For at each entryway stands a guardian who must be acknowledged. I've already spoken of these guardians of the thresholds. And we may even have our own names for these guardians if we are alert to their presence within us. A similar system, incidentally, to Teresa's may be found in the Gnostic tradition, where there's a mystical ascent through seven spheres or planetary systems, each of which is guarded at the threshold by a malevolent being called an archon. Actually, we find almost the same imagery of a sevenfold concentric series of rooms comprising the abode of the soul in some of the Sufi writings, as well as in the Zoharic mystical tradition of Judaism. And of course, we're all familiar, I am sure, or should be, with the imagery of rooms or halls in both Light on the Path and The Voice of the Silence. In Light on the Path, for example, we're introduced to only one hall, the Hall of Learning, which I would submit contains all seven chambers in Teresa's schema, while in The Voice of the Silence, we have three halls or rooms, ignorance, learning, and wisdom. But again, these two could be very easily coordinated with Teresa's sevenfold pattern. But a particular reason for choosing Teresa's imagery of the sevenfold concentric rings or rooms is that the movement she envisioned is always inward toward the center where abides the immortal self, the divine, the one who is nameless and yet is called by many names. But at the same time, it is not a movement away from the world, away from the here and now of existence, but it is a journey that bring the pilgrim soul ever closer to the center, ever more in tune with the heart of the universe, with the one, demands selfless action in the world. With each step inward, the responsibility to act in a new way increases. The world as it is seen, as it were, through the windows of each of the seven chambers, but seen always in new perspective, so that, to use a familiar concept, one is in the world, but not of it. To anticipate, however, we may recall HPB's words in The Voice of the Silence, when, as she puts it, thou shalt attain the seventh step and cross the gate, the threshold of final knowledge, when the voice of compassion is heard. Can there be bliss when all that lives must suffer? Shalt thou be saved and hear the whole world cry? And so we may say that some echoes of that voice are heard every step of the way, or using Teresa's metaphor, in every room we enter on the inward journey. It is, I propose, the threshold voice. For crossing the threshold into each of the rooms on the journey, inward demands a price. The price of moving onwards only on condition that we use whatever powers are gained for the service of the world, for the benefit of all life. To turn then to Teresa's account of that inward journey through crossing the thresholds of the seven concentric rooms, we may well keep in mind her advice that the pilgrim soul must be allowed to explore all the rooms, which means simply that we are to know and understand every aspect of ourselves. The whole self must negotiate the entry. Evelyn Underhill in The House of the Soul has said the same thing. We are required, Underhill wrote, to live in the whole of our house, learning to go freely and constantly up and down stairs, backwards and forwards, easily and willingly, from one kind of life to the other, weaving together the higher and lower powers of the soul and using both for the glory of God, for the service of humanity, the service of all living beings. So step with me across the threshold into Teresa's first room. This is the initial step that demands a real heroism. It is entry into the beginnings of self-knowledge, of becoming attentive to an inner voice, becoming aware of who we really are. Sometimes it takes more courage to begin the inward journey than to continue it, although courage, a bravery of soul, is needed to cross all the thresholds. But at this first step, often a real threshing takes hold of us. We're often pulled in two directions at once. the longing to lead a truly meaningful, genuinely spiritual life, and the desire to continue with our old habits, feeling we're not ready for so strenuous an undertaking as walking the spiritual path may demand of us. Recall, if you will, your initial response when for the first time you read the opening paragraph of Light on the Path. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. Did you feel daunted by that statement? Do you simply read it, or do you take it to heart? To be washed in the blood of the heart, that is the threshing, that is the flailing, which seems to remove all we hold most dear, to strip us inwardly naked of that all-consuming sense of egotism, of I, so much demanded, and we feel so inadequate. Dante trembled before the words inscribed on the gateway that led him first to hell on his great journey to the supreme. Across the gate, as he crossed the threshold, were the words, "Abandon every hope who entered here." But Dante's guide told him, "Here one must leave behind all hesitation. Here every cowardice must meet its death." Truly and surely, once we have glimpsed the light beyond, the work to which we have been called, there is no other way to go. We have started on our journey, and go on we must. Another threshold is to be crossed. And this is how Teresa describes it. Everyone who wishes to enter the second mansion will be well advised, as far as his state of life permits, to try to put aside all unnecessary affairs and business. There's a stage familiar to many where we determine our priorities. Are we one-pointed? Are we determined in our efforts? Consider what is important in our lives and what is not important. And so here, Teresa advises, one begins to enter into a conscious relationship with the authentic self. But note what she says further. Hearing his voice is a greater trial than not hearing it. And sometimes hearing the voice of conscience, if you want to put it that way, is a greater trial. And wishing it would shut up. So have you ever wished you hadn't heard the call to the theosophic life? Have you ever longed for the ease of non-knowing? Of course, Teresa puts the matter in very Christian terms. Remember, she wrote, that in few of the mansions are we free from struggles with devils. It is true that in some of them, the wardens, who are the faculties, have strength for the fight, but it is most important that we should not cease to be watchful against the devil's wiles. Well, you may not say the devil made me do it, but you will say, it's in the stars. I can't help it. It's in the genetic code, and so therefore the I is ever stronger. Psychic powers, of course, can even masquerade as spiritual ones. Vigilance is called for, a constant attention, as so many spiritual texts tell us. Guardians of thresholds can sometimes be most alluring, promising with their siren calls many rewards for the separate and egoistic self. Remember HPB's very graphic words in describing that myopic realm, dazzled by elusive radiance. Thy soul should linger and be caught in its deceptive light. Well, crossing the threshold into Teresa's third room means settling down to business, taking up the work in earnest, for we're now committed to walking on. There are still periods of inner aridity or barrenness, along with trying experiences and worries. Let me again quote Teresa. Burdensome, for nothing is a heavier burden than that sense of a separate. We may well be reminded here of that magnificent passage in a letter from the Mahatma K.H. to Mr. Sinnott. You were told, he wrote, that the path to occult sciences has to be trodden laboriously and crossed at the danger of life, that every new step in it leading to the final goal is surrounded by pitfalls and cruel thorns, that the pilgrim who ventures upon it is made first to confront and conquer the 1,001 furies who keep watch over its adamantine gates and entrance. Furies called doubt, skepticism, scorn, ridicule, envy, and even temptation, especially the latter. And that he who would see beyond had to first destroy this living wall, that he must be possessed of a heart and soul clad in steel and of an iron, never failing determination, and yet be meek and gentle, humble, and have shut out from his heart every human passion that leads to evil. Crossing the threshold then into the fourth chamber, a clear transition appears to be made. By now, we should be sure of our direction, although we should know there is still a great distance to travel. Listen again to what Teresa says. One noticeably senses a gentle drawing inward. The senses and exterior things seem to be losing their hold because the soul is recovering what it has lost. And then she adds further, without any effort, the soul should strive to cut down the rambling of the intellect, but not suspend either it or the mind. For it is here we learn to listen to the voice of intuition, to clear the field of consciousness, the field of the mind, so that we can hear and see the depths of our own being. This fourth stage of room, I submit, clearly marks the state referred to in the second section of Light on the Path, where the aspirant is told to enter the hall of learning. You who are now a disciple, able to stand, able to hear, able to see, able to speak, who have conquered desire and attained to self-knowledge, who have seen your soul in its bloom and recognized it, and heard the voice of the silence. Go to the hall of learning and read what is written there for you. We are, as Light on the Path further describes it, then on the threshold of becoming more than human. That is the threshold we are destined one day to cross, even though now we may only glimpse what lies in the rooms or stages beyond. But that is our destiny, if we are alert to. And so, returning to Teresa's imagery of the journey, there seems little resistance to crossing the thresholds into the fifth, sixth, and seventh rooms. The real threshing has now been accomplished. We're able to walk more freely. There are still interior trials, and all spiritual texts point to these, the crucifixions and the resurrection. For the fifth chamber is one in which the essential experience is the death rebirth, the dying to the limited self or personality in order to be reborn into the wider light of the spirit, a stage portrayed in all the great mystery schools. And so crossing the threshold into the sixth room marks the final renunciation, as the voice of the silence states, and now thyself is lost in self, thyself unto thyself,
merged in that self from which thou first didst radiate. There are still great trials, deep sufferings, a perilous threshold entailing spiritual and psychic ordeals, a place where there may also be experienced ecstatic and rapturous states. But across that threshold, for those who have the will to move on, lie unimaginable beauties, a totally new state of perception, an understanding that defies articulation. Again, as Light on the Path puts it, the knowledge which is now yours is only yours because your soul has become one, one with all pure souls and with the inmost. It is a trust vested in you by the Most High. Betray it, misuse your knowledge, or neglect it, and it is possible even now for you to fall from that high estate you have attained. Great ones fall back, even from the threshold, unable to sustain the weight of their responsibility, unable to pass on. And so Teresa points out that it's hard to distinguish between the sixth and seventh missions. And indeed, in other descriptions and other traditions, such as the Jewish and the Sufi, the symbolic descriptions of these two chambers seem to mingle into each other. Teresa tells us that we may have a sudden vision of what is in these rooms, a glorious revelation which engraves itself deeply on the memory, and yet which is terrible in its intensity and majesty. Recall the vision of Arjuna, which Arjuna saw, of Krishna in all his splendor in chapter 11 of the Bhagavad Gita. As Teresa puts it, the soul cannot endure so terrible a sight. I say terrible, she wrote, because though the sight is the loveliest and most delightful imaginable, even by a person who lived and strove to imagine it for 1,000 years, because it so far exceeds all that our imagination and understanding can encompass. Its presence is of such exceeding majesty that it fills the soul with a great terror. Those familiar with the final cantos of Dante's Circumlocution of the Spheres of Paradise in the Divine Comedy will recognize that in that work also there is a similar feeling of awe. As Dante wrote, and so my mind, bedazzled and amazed, stood fixed in wonder, motionless, intent, and still my wonder kindled as I gazed. How weak are words, and how unfit to frame the concept. And so, having crossed the last threshold, entry into Teresa's seventh mansion finds the aspirant in the still, quiet, unmoving center where abides the one self in fullness, which remains tranquil and at peace beneath the fluctuations of external action, thought, and feeling. Here, as she says, the shutters of understanding are open. We are truly at one with ourselves, balanced and centered. And we have also Dante's immortal description. High fantasy lost power and here broke off. Yet, as a wheel moves smoothly, free from jar, my will and my desire were turned by love, the love that moves the sun and the other stars. It is at that center that we are one with ourselves, and therefore one with all that lives, truly in tune with the universe. There at that center, we know it is only love that moves the sun and the other stars. Love which is infinite compassion, as it is infinite wisdom. And from that center, we must go forth to heal the world, becoming in our turn, as so many spiritual texts tell us, the teachers, the saviors, the bodhisattvas, the wise ones, the compassionate ones. We have gone within, only that we may go without, acting now in a new way, inwardly illumined and outwardly fully present in all we do and say and think. The voice of the silence speaks of the responsibility before those who move on the inward journey. When thou hast reached that state, the portals that thou hast to conquer on the path fling open wide their gates to let thee pass. So shalt thou be in full accord with all that lives. Give light and comfort to the toiling pilgrim, and seek out him who knows still less than thou. If sun thou canst not be, then be the humble planet. Point out the way, however dimly and lost among the host, as does the evening star to those who tread their path in darkness. Every day we cross thresholds. Every day there are doors to be opened, rooms to be entered. If I have a certain fascination with doors and doorways, as I do, it is because they are not only actual thresholds, but they serve as powerful images for the transitional passages that may always lead us outwards and inwards. Every moment is a doorway through which we may walk on our way toward deeper understandings, richer illuminations, ever more beautiful realization. Crossing thresholds is not a matter of linear time. It is a matter of coming awake, as did Teresa of Avila, as did Dante, as did the Buddha, as did countless other lesser seekers and teachers. Coming awake to all the possibilities that life holds for us. Coming awake to truth and beauty and goodness and love. Together, we, all humanity, all life on this shimmering planet, have crossed the threshold of what we think of as a new century, a new millennium. Perhaps, just perhaps, we here, this small group, you and I, members of the Theosophical Society, striving to live true, to use HPB's words, to the original impulses that gave the society birth, crossing all the thresholds on our own inward journey, we here may ensure, must ensure, can ensure, that HPB's prophecy will come true and Earth will be a heaven in the 21st century.